Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. Sam Taylor Johnson is a close friend and director of Back to Black, the story of Amy Winehouse. Checking in with her during filming, she always reassured me that it was intense, it was challenging, it was exhilarating. But really, Ruthie, the greatest thing about the whole process was working with the brilliant and fearless Marisa Abella. One night a few months ago, Sam called me at home to tell me Marisa was in the River Cafe and might we send her a glass of champagne. When I told this to a friend who was visiting me from New York, he said, "Ruthie, we're not sending her a glass of champagne. We're going there right now to give it to her ourselves. She's amazing." And she was, and she is. 3 days ago, Back to Black opened in London, and though I was 3,000 miles away in New York, the word traveled that it was a great movie. Today, we're here together in the River Cafe to talk about performance in the kitchen and performance in front of the camera. And afterwards, we'll have a glass of champagne. So, talking about the movie,
yeah,
it opened on Monday night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's going to ask you who was there and what did you wear. And I'm going to ask you what you ate and what did you do for food.
Let's be honest. I'm wearing like a Fendi dress that's very figure-hugging.
What does the food have to do with the Fendi dress? Were you afraid of eating too much and then
Yeah, kind of.
You kind of split the seam or something.
Right. Yeah. You want to feel your best, but it's still just sort of about like pacing and whatever. And also you get so nervous that it's just, the adrenaline is so intense.
So what did you do? Did you eat before you went? Did you have a good meal on Sunday night?
I had a good glass of red wine.
A good glass of red wine.
And I did have a good meal. I had a chicken soup. Did the premiere. That was very exciting.
Yeah. What was the most exciting moment of the premiere?
It was very important for me. It was my first ever premiere. So I was, I wanted my family to be there and my friends. And then you get five people that get to sit next to you. So, okay, who's that going to be? My mom, my dad, my whatever. But I decided that it should be my best girlfriends because they're the ones that are going to be just so excited. And I think the most purely happy moment was when I sat down next to them and the first 10 minutes or whatever, all of them just turning around to me at one specific moment, wet.
When you see the effect, that's, I couldn't possibly compare it to what we do, but having... to see the response. I was talking to Sarah Jessica Parker, and we were talking the other day about audiences.
Mm.
And I was saying, I can tell a night when we might have the same team, the sort of the same food, the place is full, but you can have at the end of it thinking, it didn't work, or yes, it did.
Right.
And I said, does that happen in theater? She said, sometimes, Ruthie, I just wonder if all those people called each other first before they came and
so
said, let's not laugh at any of the jokes. Or they call each other and they say, okay, we're going to be really responsive. It's almost the mood of, and so did you feel that from the audience?
Definitely.
And your friend?
It's also difficult to tell, especially with a film. When you're not rehearsing the scenes all the time, you film every scene individually for 3 months. It's difficult to remember exactly what's going on. Mm. And then you watch it on screen and, within the first 2 minutes, you get a big laugh or something. Mm. And you think so much about what the reaction to it's going to be that you don't even think, will people find it funny?
Yeah.
So then when people are laughing, you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. And we got a standing ovation at the end. Which is, and I think I blacked out. I didn't notice. I walked straight up to Sam and I was like, I can't believe, how do you feel? And she was like, Marisa, turn around. Like everyone is on their feet. And I was like, what? And it's wild.
When you're working, when you are filming, if you knew that you had a long day of performing different scenes, different songs, what would you eat?
Well, this is different to most of the other work I've done because I had specific needs to meet as Amy. I went through a physical transformation. So
what was that?
I lost a lot of weight to play her at certain points in her life.
How much? Do you remember?
Probably about 12 kilos.
No.
Yeah.
Well, let's stop there and tell me how you did that.
Well, essentially a plant-based, gluten-free, dairy-free, carb-free. I mean, it was sort of legumes and plants in the evenings.
In the evenings.
Yeah.
And did you find that difficult?
As you can tell, food is, But the truth is that like what it does do is that it makes those 4 months of your life completely about the work. Yes. And I'm not a method actress in that I go home and I think, am I Marisa or am I Amy? Like I know what's going on, and it's not important for me to do that. But what it does mean is that you can't get away from this work, and it is the most important thing, as it should be for that time. When it's a physical feeling like that, you can't change it, like hunger. Mm-hmm. For me, the most important thing, though, I wasn't going to do the classic, you know, you hear about these actors that are like, I was on one whatever and a cigarette a day. Mm. But it wasn't that. I ate, because for me, the most important thing always was the rest of the work. Like, can I embody her? Can I inhabit her? Can I sing? Can I move? Can I, you know, and I wasn't going to be able to do that if I had absolutely no energy. So it was sort of like a science of finding the maximum amount of energy from the minimum amount of sustenance, essentially.
As you say, you were doing it for work.
For work.
It was like for a job. It wasn't because you wanted to fit into the Fendi dress or you wanted to get a boyfriend
girlfriend.
I mean, there's so many issues.
Yeah. And also, you know, Amy had bulimia. I was playing someone with an eating disorder.
Yeah.
It's also about understanding the psychology of eating disorders, and also one eating disorder over another. It's interesting to me as an actor, you know, if someone has anorexia, that's something very different to if someone has bulimia.
Yeah.
Someone's relationship to food is interesting, I think, you know, needing to eat and purge versus not eat anything at all says something different about a person, I think.
From what age?
14.
Forever, or?
Pretty much, I think. It's difficult to say exactly, you know, especially when she was in the throes of her addiction, what her appetite was like at that point, probably incredibly low, you know, versus when you're healthier with your relationship to drugs and alcohol, your relationship to food might be different because your body changes, you know, if you're eating more because you're not using. Mm. But what we do know is that she had a difficult relationship with food and with her body image from the age of 14. As an actor, having someone tell you that you need to look a certain way for a role when that role is fictional is very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think I would struggle with that. But when it's not fictional, when she's existed and you know, her relationship to food and drugs and alcohol has affected the way that she physically manifests to all of us, then I think it's, you know, my job as an actor to do that thing.
Do you think the food was overpowering in terms of her whole character, that it was defining?
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of the reason that her addiction hit her physically as hard as it did was because she didn't have the sort of physical capability to keep up with as much as she was consuming. Yeah. But I also think that she was completely hounded by the paparazzi. One of the things that drew me to Amy as a woman was that she had this insatiable appetite for life and for music and for, you know, and that you can see that in her body when she's younger. She's not afraid to be hungry for life and for experiences and for food.
Yeah.
And as the world got more hungry for her, it's almost like they stole that appetite from her. It's almost like, you know, Ariel and Ursula, like they took her voice away from her and they took her appetite. And it's when someone is feeding on you, is there that much left? I know it's kind of sounding a bit metaphorical now,
I think that
food, if you're told as a woman in your life, like, don't take up space, you have to stop enjoying one of the simple pleasures of, you know, it's a sensual pleasure. And I don't think she was afforded many of those.
Tell me about the joy that you had during filming and about that you told us about a Christmas dinner. Yeah, what was that like?
My birthday is in December, and obviously Christmas is also in December. And my trainers said, listen, you have to give yourself one thing to work towards. So, like, you know you're going to be able to give yourself whatever you want on that day. And it can either be your birthday or Christmas, because December kind of works for us. And I was hosting Christmas that year at my flat. So it became all I could think about if I was hungry. I remember one time I got a massage. I'd booked in a massage and it was an hour and a half. And instead of relaxing during this massage, all I was thinking was, well, I'll serve, you know, little bagels with creme fraiche and I'll do caviar and I'll do this. And it was like, you know, it was a Christmas for four people. And I had a ham, a lamb, a chicken, because I was just so fixated on this food.
Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Tell me what it was like cooking with Sean here in the kitchen. You did zucchini trifolati.
Well, the thing about cooking is that, you know, it's the same with films, right? Everyone watches movies all the time and knows what they love, but doesn't necessarily know how they'd make it. And it's like, I know what I would love to eat and how I enjoy food, but watching someone really know what it is that they're doing, make something that you know is about to be delicious, is probably the same feeling that people get when they come on set and watch movies being made.
Hi, I'm Sean Owen. I'm here with Marisa Abella, and we're going to make zucchini trifolati. In case you ever have guests and you decide you're going to make zucchini trifolati, you can cut it on the chopping board, or you can just cut it like a housewife. Oh, that's my preferred method.
Yeah, I love that.
So I just cut it in my hand, like turning the zucchini as I cut.
So cool.
just put yourself in the mindset of the Italian housewife.
Yeah.
Just turn and cut and turn and cut.
I cut apples like this sometimes.
You got it. And so as many zucchini as you want. I'm not sure how many the recipe is going to be for, probably four. You'll just have a bit of garlic. We've got spring garlic now that's just arrived, which is also really amazing because the skin is so soft that you can eat the whole skin. Like you don't have to cut, you don't really have to trim it.
Right.
So I'll take that off. And that will just get put in as well. And then we're just going to fry the zucchini with like olive oil, garlic, salt and pepper over a low heat for about maybe an hour or so.
Hour
is you get perfect zucchini trifolati, like super slow, cook it super slow. And then we finish it with zucchini flowers at the end, which looks really fresh. It's a really nice thing if you have like fresh zucchini and you're growing in your garden.
It's amazing, yeah. I mean, I don't have a garden in London.
Yeah,
I
wish
I
did.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's quite an easy vegetable to grow, in truth. But the flowers are amazing in the summer, you know, and you can fry them, but also they're beautiful added to this. And this is such a nice thing to have, like, on its own with fish or meat, chicken. It's really nice, a bit of olive oil. Don't know if you can see that there. Looks a bit like sludge.
No, it looks delicious.
Sorry, don't put that in.
Yeah.
But is it all in the intensity of the cooking, down? When you slow cook something, it goes really...
And olive oil in it instead.
And good olive oil.
Right, okay.
Exactly, at the end.
Right.
So, zucchini trifolati. I hope it's cooked long enough for Ruthie. You can cook it long
enough. Zucchini trifolati. 18 small zucchini trimmed and cut. 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 garlic cloves peeled and sliced, a handful of mint or basil roughly chopped, sea salt and freshly ground black pepper. Heat the oil in a large frying pan. Add the garlic and gently brown. Then add the zucchini and cook slowly for 15 to 20 minutes. When brown on all sides, add 125 milliliters of boiling water and stir, scraping and combining the juices until the water has been absorbed and the zucchini is soft. Add the mint or basil, season with salt and pepper, and serve.
You chose the recipe for zucchini trifolati.
I did,
and why? Why did, of all the recipes, because it's one of my favorites,
right.
And it's one of the first vegetables I ever learned to cook in that process.
I love eating zucchini out.
Mm-hmm.
Courgette. Mm-hmm. Same thing?
Same thing, French or Italian.
Right. I love eating it out, but whenever I cook it, I don't get it quite right. I feel like I don't know whether I don't season it completely right, or it can go kind of like too soft, too easily for me, or whatever it is. But whenever I eat it out, it's like, oh my God, what is this delicious, especially in pasta and in... So I think when I saw it today, I was like, well, this is a perfect way to just... Yeah. Maybe it was quite selfish. And also, the timing, she said an hour. I'm bad at putting things on high for a short period of time. I guess I'm quite impatient.
Come on, cook.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, come on, let's go.
Let's hurry this along.
Exactly. Also, I get very hungry very quickly.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm at home. I'm like, oh, I'll make dinner tonight. Don't worry about it. And then all of a sudden, 15 minutes, I'm like, I'm starving. I don't know about you. I'm going to die.
But boil water.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Cook pasta.
Yeah.
I think that the French are like very al dente. You know, they like things quite crispy. And the Italians... really like to slow cook their vegetables.
Right.
And get more flavor out of it. Maybe it's the olive oil that is then absorbed into it over a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. The process of sort of slightly going brown and then soft and then brown again.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians cook vegetables for... You're British, I know, so I have to be careful not
but
to
Maltese
insult
too.
You.
Maltese too.
Okay, so then kind I could say that why is it that when the Italians cook vegetables for a long time, they get better, and when... English people cook vegetables for a long time.
Yeah.
They kind of get worse.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said, I remember saying years ago that nobody really had time to cook anymore. And that's, you know, it's a shame. And he said, yeah, but except for the English, maybe cabbage, where they'll say, oh, we only have 45 minutes to cook the cabbage.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe that would speed up. But I think zucchini does, we do some that, actually, I don't think we do any zucchini that is crisp, but because even if we boil it, we boil it for longer whole and then slice it up and put it with olive oil and mint.
Right.
But,
well, that's something that I've learned today.
Yeah.
See?
There you go.
That's good.
So what was it like growing up in your home in terms of food? Because you do seem you say you love to eat. Tell me about the early days of your childhood and food. What are your memories?
I grew up at home with my mom and my brother and me. It's just the three of us. And my mom is a great cook. There was always a lot of food, you know? Like, that was the thing. Quantity was key in my house. Like, loads of food. There was never a question of anyone going hungry. And it was also such a big way of showing love, I think. You know, my mum, if I was feeling sad, it was food. If I was feeling happy, it was food.
What was her background? Did she grow up in a house like that as well?
I don't know. Actually, I think my mum grew up quite scared of food. My mum is Jewish. I think food in the Jewish culture is so important, you know? So I think and my mum didn't have a huge appetite growing up, but it was very like, finish what's on your plate.
Do you know about your grandmother, where she came? Was she born in Britain?
Well, so there are two sides. Both sort of during the Second World War, they were my mother's father's family emigrated from Poland, and my mother's family were from Austria.
Yeah. Because I think there's also something perhaps about an immigrant family in a possibly threatening environment.
Yeah.
My family came from Russia and from Hungary, again, emigrated. And there definitely was a feeling that in an alien environment where you were concerned about the protection of your children, food was a kind of way of almost creating a barrier of safety for your kids.
Totally.
And, you know, the thing of coming home, I always tell the story that apparently my grandmother came to visit her first grandson, my brother, and she came. She used to travel with her rolling pin, you know, and so she arrived in the house in the country, and my mother said, "Do you want to see the baby?" And she said, "Let's eat first," you know? And so I think that culture, but it may be, you know, I'm Jewish, and so I think that probably is a Jewish characteristic, but probably if you had an African family in, you know, a white society that felt threatened, or, you know, a Catholic family in Belfast, that food would maybe become even more.
Totally. You know. And, like, my mum grew up in Northwest London, so I grew up in Brighton. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a massive Jewish community at all where I grew up, but we were probably the only household. There were lots of supermarkets in Brighton where you could get whatever it was you wanted to eat. But my mum would have to go to the Waitrose if she wanted anything that was kosher.
Yeah, kosher.
Right. Really. Oh, no, but my mum will only eat kosher smoked salmon. She doesn't like other smoked salmon because it's too oily. Mm-hmm. You know, she likes sort of kosher sausages and gefilte fish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she likes that food. So if she wouldn't eat kosher necessarily, keep kosher, but she had to go to that Waitrose to get that food. So mine was the only house in Rotting Dean, you know, in Brighton, that had chopped liver in the fridge. But it was, I mean, but my brother and I were quite kind of embarrassed of that food, I think. Yeah. It's weird. It's kind
of
weird.
Well, you want to kind of adapt, don't
you?
I mean, I think you want to, whereas your mother might have been proud to do that. The children are much more kind of protective of their identity and wanting to, you know, become like the people next door, their school friends, not be different.
And I think that because she was a single mother too, it was very much like I think, you know, when you have two kids under the age of four, we're not eating gefilte fish. So she would eat alone a lot, not alone with us, but eat her own meal. And we did that a lot, actually, growing up. You know, my brother loved shellfish, and I loved red meat, and my mum loved whatever, you know, and we would eat different things.
At the same table.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it was funny, I was actually telling a friend just now that, you know, I before I met my boyfriend that I'm with now, that's here.
You come and join the conversation.
I didn't like to share food, and I think that that's kind of why, because we'd go out for dinner and it would be like, I'll have my thing, you have yours. It was weird for me. Also, small plates restaurants is such a thing now, you know, a thing in London. For me growing up, if we went out for dinner, I would get a bowl of pasta, you know, a carbonara, let's say. My brother would get the prawns with garlic and chili, and my mum would get the chicken, and we wouldn't share. You know, it was that. And my mum was very good at spending that time making what it was that we wanted.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. But what it meant was that, and up until a couple of years ago, really, I was not good at sharing food. Well, now the only thing that I refuse to share is soup. Because I think that's gross.
Yeah, that's gross. Right. I agree.
Thank you. Thank you. And people also say you shouldn't share omelets.
Okay.
But I like omelets. I don't mind sharing an omelet.
Well, it's all about the double dipping.
Right.
But I think COVID also changed a lot of that, don't you?
Sure,
you know, the sort of fear around that.
But
did you have Friday night suppers? Well, I guess you didn't.
At my mother's family's house, we would travel up to Highgate by that point where my grandfather was living, and we'd do Passover, definitely.
Mm. But did your father cook?
My dad does cook, but he cooked, my dad's Maltese.
Mm-hmm. What is Maltese food?
It's kind of like a mix, just like the language of Arabic and Italian, because it's in between North Africa, Libya, and Sicily.
So great mix.
It's incredible. Yeah. But the food is, you know, it's also in terms of produce, it's not the best place. Yeah. So like the food is yummy, but it's lots of rabbit.
Or, you know, the Friday night supper in Jewish households is like, I guess it's a bit like the Sunday lunch with more religion, you know, that you read. Did you do the readings and the
I had to sing the Manish Tana and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, I remember, you know, the actual food on Passover being just sort of like some horrible, cruel event. But then it's like, you know, roast chicken or whatever it was. Lots of fish too. And I only started liking fish a couple of years ago.
So now, you grew up really loving food,
loving
to eat,
Very much so. And, you know, if I woke up one morning and was like, I don't want to go to school today, my mom would bribe me by taking me to the bakery before school so I could get a croissant. Like, it was all, you know. Yeah. And I'd have, sometimes she'd pick me up every Thursday night with a chicken katsu curry before I went to netball.
Before.
I mean, I don't know how I did that, you know,
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
When you grew up in this household of your, you know, everybody having a meal, whether it was all 3 separate foods, and then you left home to go to, did you go to RADA right away?
I went
away?
To RADA, yeah.
And was that an awakening? Was it different?
It was.
Shocking? Did you live in an apartment?
I lived in an apartment in Willesden Green with 3 people that were in my year, but I'd never met before that time. I mean, I ate a lot of like things on toast, to be honest.
Did you?
Mushrooms on toast. I had a lot.
That's good.
I'd put like pesto in with my mushrooms. Nice. Yeah. And I'd have that on toast almost every night. There was a fish and chip shop. I didn't like fish then, so I'd get like a saveloy and chips.
What made you start liking fish, do you think?
When I had a year off, I went to Fiji. There was like a sustainability thing that we were living on this tiny island, and if you didn't eat fish...
That's far.
Yeah, very far. If you didn't eat fish, you had to eat pumpkin. Mm-hmm. And I was like, great, I'll eat pumpkin. But after a month of eating pumpkin, you're like, I'm going to die if I don't eat something other than pumpkin. So I started to try fish, and I got better and better.
How old were you?
18.
Yeah. And apart from Malta, did your parents take you to Italy or to France? Were you exposed to other cultures of food?
You know, my mom was very busy trying to keep everything afloat. If I went on holiday, I went away more with my dad. But he took us to some amazing places. I went to Egypt when I was 11.
Wow.
And I remember my dad having pigeon.
A whole one?
Yeah, a whole pigeon and getting food poisoning.
Oh.
And then we went to the pyramids and my dad passed out in a pyramid, which was quite scary. Yeah. So I remember, you know, I remember going away a lot. You know, I went away with my dad, but it was mostly Malta. I didn't like travel a lot, you know, as a kid, to be honest. I only went to America for the first time a couple years ago. And I'm about to go to LA for my first time.
Is LA the premiere in LA?
There's a screening in LA, and it'll be my first time.
Wearing the same Fendi dress, or do you get
a different thing.
Did you have to give it back? No,
that's mine. I think it's custom, so I think that's mine. I mean, it had my name in the label, so I hope so. And again, it's like that's what's fun to me is where am I going to eat in LA?
Yeah.
Where am I going to eat in New York when I'm there in Paris? All of those things.
I think that's interesting. I always like that question when, you know, asking people who do travel for either their, you know, acting or for other reasons that they have to travel. They're the people who really research where they're going to find out where they're going to eat and maybe go to the markets to see you know, what's in season and what's in the market. Do you go to sleep at night thinking what you're going to eat the next day?
I definitely did while I was on this diet.
Yeah.
Or what I'd love to eat, you know. But I've become better at understanding what it is that my body needs at different times. I'm not as obsessed with food as I have been at certain points in my life.
How do you feel having finished playing Amy?
It's been a while since we wrapped. It's been about a year. But it was difficult, you know. I was so invested emotionally and physically and psychologically in that world. So it was kind of insane to step out of it. It didn't really feel real. Every time I see Amy anywhere and hear her anywhere, it's definitely means something different to me now than it did before. I'm incredibly proud of what it is that we've made. And, you know, when you get to finally enjoy the work and sit in the cinema and watch it with all those people and have the kind of reaction that we had on Monday night, it feels like, amazing, you know.
Before we started, we were talking about comfort, and I was saying that we always ask everybody because the answers are so different. But if you were to think about a food that you would go to for comfort when you were either worried or concerned or sad or loss or whatever it was that you just wanted something that would make you feel better through eating, is there a comfort food that you would go to?
Yes. I mean, my mum used to make me a risotto when I was younger, and it was very much the, like, Marisa's having a bit of a sad day, and this is what she needs to eat. And it was a risotto, really, that was probably for about four people that I ate all by myself. And how I don't know how sort of like authentic it was. I think sometimes she would use like risotto rice and sometimes it would be like basmati rice. If that's what she had in the fridge, in the cupboard. But, you know, it was a bacon and pea risotto and it was delicious. And now if I'm feeling sad still, I would call my mom and ask her to make me that risotto.
Okay. Well, then she would, I'm sure.
Definitely, she'd have to.
would you ever make it yourself?
I don't think it would be the same.
We can make that. The peas are in season right now.
With it.
So the next time if you come, call me and we'll make that for you.
Oh, okay? My gosh, amazing.
Why not? Thank you, darling.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at betterhelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.